Okay, I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. At this time, as we've done for 37 years, let's see now, 1982, and 37 years. The TechNet represents the gathering of curious radio amateurs who want to know more about wireless equipment, transmitters, receivers, antennas, feed lines, propagation, 26 or 27 different kinds of ham radio, to gather here and teach each other what they've learned by word of mouth and internet connections and so on. The TechNet is broken up into roughly three sections. The first section where people sign in because they do have a question or a comment. They give us their call letters, their name, and the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 37 years of under one leadership, this net is one of the longest lasting, we believe. We're convinced somebody is listening, or it wouldn't have lasted this long. Let me drop. The second portion of the TechNet is where Dr. Roy, AC2GS, gives us the science talk in the mailbag. And he's back this week after being away for a while. And we'll be looking forward to puzzles and statements. And the third section is where Paul, WS2N, tells us a space report. What's the latest going on with NASA and the launchings of the United States and any other country who has a space program. So at this time, I'm going to take check-ins for people who do have a question or a comment. You're going to tell me your call letters. Please tell me your name, because I'm so forgetful. And the word yes, meaning you do have a question or a comment. K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick, and we're listening for check-ins at this time.
K2RIW, this is N2 AM, Dave, with a question.
Very well done, N2 Alpha Alpha, Mike, I think it is, Dave. Okay, so far we get Rich and Dave. Anyone else to check into the TechNet tonight? Please give me your call letters and your name, just like Dave did. Right now, K2RIW listening. One last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet tonight? Because they do have a question or a comment. Please give me a call letters and name right now. Well, maybe we're going to have a late night tonight, or maybe some people will sign in a little bit later. So let's start off with Rich. WB2GXM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich. How are those electrons in your town treating you?
K2RIW in the group, WB2GXM. The electrons are a little sluggish. It's been cold. But so far, so good. So my question. I have a number of boat anchors. At the time these boat anchors were created, most of them are Heath kits, the voltage coming out of the house wiring was somewhere around 115 to 117 volts. Of course, it's a lot higher today. It can be over 120 volts. I have been advised to operate my boat anchors through step-down transformers. I know Bob Heil is at least one person who does this with his boat anchors. And I have collected two auto transformers and one variable AC power supply. Now my question, I was wondering if there is a cheaper, less bulky way to do this. WBGGXM.
Well, first of all, Rich, the difference between 115 and 122 volts, is that enough to damage a boat anchor? I'm skeptical of that. However, if you're convinced there is a difference, the least expensive way I can think of lowering that voltage is with a filament transformer. If you have your 110 volts coming in such that it's also firing up the primary of a filament transformer, 6.3 or 12 volts, and you have your 115 volts in series with that secondary winding, the 6.3 volts output of the secondary winding can either add or subtract 6.3 volts. Or if it's a 12-volt filament transformer, you can subtract 12 volts. The filament winding is good for a number of amperes, so it has no trouble conducting the amperes of the 110 volts. So a filament transformer in series with 110 volts being fed to your boat anchor, could lower it by 6 or 12 volts exactly, and do it with a very low impedance. To do it with a voltage drop with a resistor, it would be very load sensitive, you know, depending on how much current you're drawing, you'll get different amounts of voltage drop. With that filament transformer, you'll get exactly 6.3, or unloaded, maybe it puts out 6.6. You get exactly 6.6 volts of lowering with that filament transformer out of phase. Do you have that picture, or should I describe that a little bit more, Rich? That's the way I would do it. WB2GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet. Drag your feet a little bit in case someone else wants to add something to this one. Over to you, Rich, with a delay.
Yes, I have a comment on that, WHCDL. And well done, Dick. That's the way I would do it, too. It's even in the handbook. Back to you.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about that, Andy. You've apparently done this and was very successful. Tell me when you did it. What made you do it? Are you sure that a boat anchor is that sensitive to a little bit of extra voltage? WHCDL, K2RIW in the net.
Okay, I'd like to know what boat anchors GXM has, because I have a bunch myself, and not to take anything away from the net. I did it a couple of years ago, and I just did it just for fun. I just wanted to see how well it worked. I didn't actually need it in this application, but I just wanted to lower the primary voltage of a power transformer, and using the bucking effect of the secondary of the transformer, just like you described, it worked fine. And of course, you don't have to be using 6.3 volt filament transformers. There are 5 volt filament transformers, and there's 12.6 filament transformers. You know, there's many different secondary voltages, but it does work, and theoretically, it makes sense. It changes the phase so it doesn't add, it subtracts, and it will subtract from the primary voltage, and it'll lower the voltage, and it's a good way of doing it. So I just wanted to mention that. But I'm also curious, what boat anchors does Rich have as compared to what I have? Dick, I'll give it back to you.
Very fine, Andy, and thank you for that information. Rich, what makes this work so well is the output impedance of a 6.3 or a 12.6 volt filament transformer, the output impedance of that secondary winding is so low that the voltage you're across it is almost independent of how much current you're drawing. Almost any other technique, a variac transformer is a very expensive approach, and it wouldn't work as well as a filament transformer. So because that output impedance is so low, whether you're drawing a 5 amperes or 0 amperes, it's going to be putting out 6.3 or 6.2 or 6.4, something very close to the 6.3, very low output impedance, and for that filament winding to have enough insulation to tolerate the 110 volts, very easy to do. And I guess one of your first questions would be, do I wire the filament transformer on the hot lead or the cold lead? And I think the answer is you do it on the hot lead. You'd like the white wire to be left intact, and the black wire from your 110 volts is the one you put in series with the filament transformer. So back to you, Rich, to answer Andy's question, which boat anchors, and does the procedure sound reasonable for you? You get the picture. WB2GXM, K2RIW. Go ahead, Rich.
Thank you, Dick. Andy, I primarily would use it on my Heathkit DX60B transmitter. I also have an HW16, which may or may not be pressed into service. And I'm not sure that my Drake equipment needs this, but that might be a consideration. The primary use would be for the DX60B. I'm having a little bit of trouble visualizing the schematic. Maybe if I emailed you, Dick, you could make a rough drawing and email that back to me. And then I would try that out, WB2GXM.
Okay, right now I'm going to describe it to you, Rich. The filament transformer is going to be wired directly to your 115/120 volts. Let's assume you're getting 120 volts. 120 volts is going to go to the primary winding of the filament transformer. The voltage that you're about to send to your boat anchor, the white lead is going to go straight to the boat anchor. That's the so-called return lead. The black lead of your 115 volts is going to go to one of the two wires of the secondary winding of the filament transformer. The other winding, the other wire of the filament transformer goes to the boat anchor. So the secondary winding of the filament transformer is in series with the hot lead, the black lead, going to the boat anchor. And depending on which polarity you use on the secondary winding, you can tell with your voltmeter real fast, is the voltage coming out of the second wire going to the boat anchor, is it 6 volts higher or 6 volts lower? If it's 6 volts higher, you've got it wired the wrong way. You just reverse the two leads of the filament transformer. So filament transformer gets the full 120 volts. The secondary winding is in series with the black lead, the hot lead, going to the boat anchor. The output of the filament transformer goes to the boat anchor. Do you see that picture? WB2GXM, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I believe so. The primary of the filament transformer is connected in parallel across the supply line to the boat anchor. And then the secondary is wired in series with that line.
Negative. The filament transformer sees the full 120 volts. So the 120 volts go straight to the primary winding of the filament transformer. The secondary winding of the filament transformer is put in series with the black lead, the hot lead from your 120 volts, that goes to the boat anchor. So, filament transformer sees the whole 120 volts, secondary winding, which would have been 6.3, maybe it's 6.5, because it's seeing 120 instead of 115. That winding is in series with the hot lead going to the boat anchor. The boat anchor then sees 120 volts plus or minus the 6.3, depending on which polarity you use on either the primary or the secondary of the filament transformer. Reverse either one of those, and the in-phase becomes out-of-phase, and so you can buck it by 6 volts or add it 6 volts to the voltage going to the boat anchor. So, filament transformer sees the full 120 volts. Over to you, Rich, for any further questions. Go ahead and ask them. WB2GXM, K2RIW.
It sounds good, and I will try it. But that black wire, that hot lead, branches off. It exceeds the filament transformer primary, of course. But then it also goes across to one side of the secondary, and then the other side of the secondary goes to the boat anchor.
You've got the picture. You've got it correct. So, black and white lead from your 120-volt supply goes directly to filament transformer primary. Secondary is going to have the 6.3-volt winding of the filament transformer in series with the black lead. And depending on whether or not you get the polarity right, your voltmeter will show that the boat anchor is either seeing 120 minus 6, which would be 114, or 120 plus 6, which would be 126. So depending on what voltage is going to the boat anchor by your voltmeter, you'll know immediately whether or not you've got the polarity of the filament transformer correct. And you can reverse the polarity of the filament transformer either by flipping the two secondary leads if you want to, or flipping the two primary leads if you want to. Either one will do the job. And make the voltage from the filament transformer in phase or out of phase, so that it's either adding 6 volts or subtracting 6 volts. WB2GXM, K2RIW.
I have a question regarding...
Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, yeah, Rich, I'm familiar with the DX60. I've had so many radios time to time. And I would call that a pretty light boat anchor, because the weight of that compared to, you know, some of the radios that I have is really much lighter. It uses a simple 6146 in the final, and I'm sure you're familiar with that. And of course, it's an AM/CW transmitter only. It does not do sideband. But my question is, why do you have to add this filament transformer in the first place? The DX60 is a pretty rugged transmitter and can tolerate the voltage variances on the primary side, your line voltage. It's really not that critical. I think it's 90 watts DC input is the, if I'm not mistaken, is the what it's rated for. So it could be used for novice use. Actually, I thought it was 75 watts. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But anyway, you know, it just uses a simple 6146. It doesn't put out a lot of power. You're not talking about, you know, 500 watts. I have transmitters that put out 1,000 watts. And those are much heavier, the gigantic power transformers. So what's the reason for this, Rich? I'm just curious. I think I'll give it back to you.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Fair question, Andy. I'm just trying to prolong the life of the DX60B. It's very close to my heart, figuratively speaking, and I like to treat it well. So if there really isn't any big whoop about 115 or 120 volts, I could live with that too, and I'm sure the DX60B could also. And frankly, my floor will not tolerate anything heavier than that DX60B. No real boat anchors here. They'll go right through. WB2GXM.
Andy, I am guessing you might have gone to the Hall of Science flea market today, Hammer or whatever it's called. What was it like? I think you said that the attendance is getting a little bit light because everybody's doing things by internet these days, I guess by, I can't even think of the name of the place that people go to sell things. So tell us a little bit what that was like. Debate your CDL, K2RIW.
Okay, before I go into that, I just want to, you know, finish with Rich, just to tie the ribbons on it. Sounds like, Rich, you need some more floorboards, or you need some floor support if you're going to put something heavier on the floor that you're on so you won't go through. Yeah, I know what that's like. If you really want to know what a transmitter is really like, look up, and this is just information, look up a military T-368, and that's T as in Thomas 368, and it's a transmitter that I own, and it's on a dolly, it's on wheels, it comes in three sections. There's a modulator section, a power supply, and an exciter section. And this thing weighs, without kidding, 650 pounds. Yes, that's right, 650 pounds. That's the actual gross weight of this particular transmitter. And puts out 1,500 watts. Uses 4-125s and the modulator and a single 4-400 in the final. And the power supply alone is 300 pounds. That's a boat anchor. Believe it or not. If you ever want to see it, I can show it to you. You can look up pictures of it. So, you got something light. And incidentally, yes. So let me just stick with your permission. Let me go back to Rich to see if he has any other questions regarding that. Because I don't think it's necessary to do what he wants to do. I know his DX60 is precious to him, and I'm sure he'll get, if you tune it up properly and you don't exceed the plate current, your final tube will last a long time, and really, they're pretty good transmitters. Heathkit did a good job designing it. Dick, back to you on that.
Go right ahead, Rich.
Thank you, Andy. I needed that. It's been a pretty depressing day, and I appreciate. I'm glad you brought those comments out. That's cool. Good speed with your transmitting equipment, sir, and thousands of pounds of stuff. That's awesome. Thanks for the information, guys. K2RIWWB2GXM.
That real heavy transmitter you just described, Andy, I am guessing that is an amplitude modulated, high level modulation. In other words, to put out 1500 watts with that Dash 800 tube, the final RF tube, to amplitude modulate, that means you need half of that, 750 watts of audio power, which is bucking and boosting the voltage going to that final stage, probably something around 2000 volts. So you need 750 watts of audio powering the final stage at 1500 watts to get full 100% amplitude modulation out of that transmitter. That's a guess on my part. Is that approximately what's going on and why it's so healthy? WA2CDL, K2RIW.
Yes, what you described is true. And all I can say is, you know, danger, high voltage. You got to be very careful when you work on this thing and make sure everything is, all your filter caps are discharged. Yeah, the plate voltage, I forget exactly what it is. It's in the order of 2,500 or more on the plate. And yes, you need about, like you say, you need half your modulating power to modulate it 100%. And it is only AM and CW, and that's it. It's only designed, and it's a military device, military transmitter. In fact, the matching receiver, probably most people have heard of the R390, which is also a military tube-type receiver, which I have also, and that matches it. So it comes as a set. They even have a matching antenna tuner for it also. So, yes, I have that set up. Although I'm not using it right now, but I have it. It's wired directly into my circuit breaker panel. I have a 60 amp circuit breaker panel that I put in, and it's wired into that. it won't make the lights go dim in the house. But the DX60, as I said, you know, with 90 watts or so, you know, you're talking about approximately 800 or so volts on the plate, and about 250 to 300 mils of current, you know, on your tube, your 6146. So, you know, that's about normal for, you know, to put out 100 watts or so. So, you know, nothing compared to what I'm describing. So, Rich, you'll have no problem with that. Just using it the way it is. And I don't know if you bought it new and built it yourself, or you bought it used, but they sold a lot of those DX60s. There's a matching receiver for it also, where he's getting made, and I forget the model number of that. Let me drop it, and I'll tell you about the flea market, because I think we're done with Rich.
Yes, sir, I'd like to hear about that flea market. Go ahead, WB2GXM.
And Andy, when you spoke into the microphone of that 1500 watt AM transmitter, even though you're feeding it on the 240 volt line, as you speak into the microphone, you are generating, or not generating, 750 watts of audio going into that final stage. So as you speak into the microphone, didn't the lights flicker a little bit in your house? To B2CDL, K2RIW.
Not really. At least I didn't notice it. No. Well, because I have it wired, I have a separate 60 amp sub panel connected to my main circuit breaker panel. So I got a sub panel, and it's wired directly into that. And that's what I did. With pretty heavy gauge neoprene wire that I bought at Home Depot. You know, like a number 10 gauge wire or so that's feeding this thing. Yeah, it's pretty rugged, this thing. And believe it or not, there are quite a few in use, And there's a net. I check into some AM nets, and that's why I'm mentioning this. And these nets are on 75 meters. They meet on Sunday mornings and Saturday mornings. You can, if you scan the band, you can listen to the nets that are on. And there's a couple of guys using these transmitters. So, you know, they've been around a long time, and they're quite popular on that. So, but my lights do not dim, at least over here. Dick, back to you.
I think it's somewhere around 3910 or so that these guys on the AM net meet on Sunday morning. And when those AM transmitters come on the air, you hear a bang if it's 1,500 watts of average power, when they're not speaking into the microphone, that means the peak envelope power of that transmitter is 6,000 watts. That's an interesting transmitter, Andy. And do you feed all that power into a dipole? And it better be a pretty healthy dipole. Debate your CDL with Call of Science and a little bit more about that high power transmitter. Over to you, Andy, K2RIW.
Yeah, I'm actually not using the that transmitter. I haven't used it in a while because I've had some antenna things that I have to fix up before I put that kind of power into a simple dipole antenna to make sure there's no sparking and arcing that's going to cause anything. You know, especially with that kind of power going into a dipole antenna. So I don't have it online. And of course, you know, given the FCC ruling and what your legal limit is, I gotta, you know, be careful. The transmitter is capable of putting out more power than the legal limit. So I gotta stay within those rules and regulations. That, but I'm not using that right now. I'm using much smaller transmitters. And what I mean by smaller, I have a Johnson Valiant that also uses 6146s, but uses two of them. And I also have my old trusty Ico 720. That's a classic. That's been around a long time. That also uses 6146s, a tube. And you see how popular these tubes are. 6146s, I tell you, are great tubes. And just as a footnote, I don't know why some of these Japanese companies decided to go away from 6146s, except for Heathkit. Heathkit is one of the few. If you look at the SB-102 and the HW-101, they always use 6146s. These other Japanese companies, like Yaesu, for instance, came out with like their FT-101 using sweep tubes. Compactron sweep tubes in the final, rather than these more rugged tubes that I'm mentioning. I don't know if you know about that, but not to take up too much more airtime, I did take, and this was back in the 70s. I took an FT-101 because they were popular back then, which used the sweep tubes, and I replaced it with 6146s. Given that the tube was more rugged, I had to rebias the tube, obviously, you know, for sideband, because it is a sideband transmitter, but I got rid of the sweep tubes, so I don't like them. I don't know why some companies would use them. They're cheap, they're readily available, using TV sets, and they do work, because they're designed for the frequencies that are used on HF, but they're not as rugged, so... All right, I'm getting sidetracked here. Dick, let me give it back to you, and then I'll just mention the flea market quickly.
Yeah, that 6146 is such a popular tube, so that there must be zillions of them, both brand new and used, on the various places where you can buy them. And when people have a transmitter that uses a pair of them, they think they're compelled to buy 6146s or similar tubes in matched pairs. I think that's really not required in most transmitters, particularly if they're used in parallel. If they're being used in push-pull, maybe there's a slight advantage in buying a matched pair. So, what's a brand new 6146 cost these days? Is it close to $100? Over to you, Andy, K2RIW.
Okay, I would imagine yes. Probably if you look online, even on eBay, you'll find them because they're very popular. They've been around a long time, and so many different transmitters use them. They became the standard of the industry. And everybody, if you mention 6146, most people who know transmitters would say, yeah, it's the final tube. They would just know it. The driver tube that drives it, that's a little bit different. That's a 12BY7, which is a popular tube. And that's the driver tube, and that's been around a long time, too. So, yeah, a little bit pricey for a tube, but, not compared to, the more expensive tubes. And, of course, you're familiar with the 4CX250s. Dick, you probably know that the 6ATT, which is another, I would call it a military number, that's the airborne HF radio transceiver that's used on planes. That uses 4CX250s in the final for that radio. So that's and that radio operates on a 28 volt supply, because 28 volts was common in aircraft, as you know. I used to work on them when I worked in the aircraft field. When I worked for a company, that's how I know. But 6146s. Or 4CX250Bs, you could use those on HF, but not too many transmitters use those because they're more expensive tubes. As you know, you've used them in your kilowatt amplifier because they're good for that frequency range as well. They have a much wider bandwidth. Is that right, Dick? As far as I remember.
Yeah, 6146. Correction, 4CX250B is one of my favorite tubes. It's got a 250 watt dissipation. I think a 6146, I think it's only got 25 watts of plate dissipation. 4CX250B, you blow enough air through that external anode metal structure. It'll dissipate 250 watts, runs on 2000 volts. Single tube is rated all the way up to 500 megahertz. A pair of them in a parallel kilowatt amplifier can easily put out 700 watts, key down. And for people who raise the voltage a little bit on screen or plate or both, and can get as much as 2,000 watts out of that parallel kilowatt amplifier. Used 4CX250Bs. There were times when they were in good shape, and you could buy them for $25 a piece because the FAA was using them in their transmitters, and the FAA would switch them out after some number of hours of operation. And the tubes themselves are good for many thousands of hours. So the FAA was using only 15 or 20% of the life of those tubes and selling them on the flea markets. And so they were really healthy. And the really stoochy version of that tube is the one made by RCA with the red ceramic insulation. 4CX250R, and they could put out considerably more power. So a very healthy tube. Tetrobe, and on 432 megahertz, I think it requires 10 watts of drive per tube, and each individual tube will put out 350 watts with less than 10 watts of drive. So what was Hall of Science like today? To B2CDL, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay, very good. Yes, I know that you are the one of the few that use 4CX250Bs in the projects that you've built, and they're very good tubes, like you say. They're very rugged, and they hold up. You just have to make sure that you don't run the filament higher than normal as far as the voltage. I understand the filament voltage is 5 volts, and it's critical. So you got to make sure that even the filament supply could be well regulated so it doesn't vary too much. And, of course, you mentioned the air. If you get enough air blowing around that tube will last a long time because it's designed for air cooling. So, as you said. All right. sonar was light, lighter than it's been in the past, but, you know, which I expected because, you know, over time, things are thinning out. You know, flea markets are not as crowded and as they used to be years ago. You know, with the tune-up table that I've been doing since I started in the 80s, you know, things have changed. You know, and technology has changed, and you don't see too many kids anymore. You just don't see the youngsters come around. So, although I'm always busy with something, somebody always comes around to the table. I was down in North Carolina at Shelby, and I was there for the ham fest that they had, and that was Labor Day weekend. And the turnout there was light, too, lighter than last year. It was actually a little bit disappointing because normally it's a three-day event and people packed up after one day and left. Although, and the weather was excellent. Beautiful sunny skies, no clouds, no rain, and people left early. It was crowded in the beginning, but then it thinned out pretty quick, so maybe people are just not spending enough money, no money at all. The other one I'm going to is this week. I'm leaving Thursday for a Nearfest up in New Hampshire, and that's a good one. That one I like, and that's where I meet all the AMers that I speak to on 75. They all congregate up there. So, of course, most of the activity on 75 that I'm on AM that I'm active is up and down the Eastern Seaboard. So. You know, we talk to people in Connecticut and Massachusetts, New Hampshire, Vermont, Maine, and so on. So they show up there, and we actually have a dinner, or they have a dinner, and it's called an AM dinner where everyone meets together and, you know, shoots the breeze, and it's a lot of...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, now I got it. All right, sorry about that. I'm listening to myself, so I know when I time out. But when you time out, you got to wait a couple of seconds for it to reset. So I'll be going up to New Hampshire. I'm leaving Thursday. And it's also a two-day event, so I'm looking forward to that. Although, I hear now the long-range forecast is rain. And I hope it doesn't do that. And of course, it's going to be a lot colder up there, so I'll dress warmly. But that'll be a lot of fun. Dick, can I just mention something off the record regarding my car? Because I just bought a new car, and I want to tell you something about what I found out. It'd be interesting to have a discussion, in my opinion, about new car technology, which my car has, just to change the subject, but. And not to go into it very deeply, but just to mention it.
We got plenty of time tonight, Andy. Only two people signed in, so take your time. Go ahead.
Okay. I just bought a new car in August, and one of the reasons why is to take it to North Carolina, which I did. So I took it on a nice long trip. Wait, hold on. Somebody trying to get in? I heard a headset noise. Okay. Just off the record, it's a good thing that I questioned this and I got an answer, which was pretty good. As you know, car technology, as far as electronics and safety, is changing over time. Eventually, we're not going to be driving our cars anymore. We'll be going into a car, pressing a couple of buttons, and the car will just drive itself. And that's the trend. So. This particular car, which is a Subaru, has what's called EyeSight, and it works really well. So there's two things I want to mention is the way the EyeSight works, and it's an option that I wanted. Because I'm getting older, my reflexes are not as good as it used to be. EyeSight basically is what it, as the meaning says, it looks around and sees what's ahead of the car, and changes its speed accordingly, or will actually stop. And I had a chance to try this. When you go into cruise control, and you have the eyesight activated, my car will determine its speed based on the car ahead of it. So what I had a chance to do is to use this feature when I was on the open road, you know, traveling the long distance. I was on Route 81 heading south, and I was in the right-hand lane, and I was traveling at 70 miles an hour, and that's the speed limit or so. And then a car was on the entrance lane ahead of me and got on to the right-hand lane as the car entered, and of course was going a lot slower than I was going, and my car sensed that automatically and started to slow down until it reached the same speed as the car was going in front of me. Then I noticed that as the car in front of me sped up, my car sped up. So it followed that to the limit that I had the cruise control set at, because you set the cruise control for a certain limit that it won't go any faster. But the interesting part about this, and let me just let it drop so I don't time it.
And my first question is, did it automatically adjust the spacing between you and the car ahead of you dependent on the speed you both were traveling to be the safe spacing distance? Over to you, Andy.
Yes, it did. I could not accelerate to get any closer to the car in front of me, which I thought was fantastic. So the answer to that question is quickly yes, and then I'll continue.
Go right ahead.
Yeah, so, you know, this eyesight is actually two cameras that are mounted on the, you know, behind the windshield. And I guess, it acts like radar, so it sees what's ahead. So the interesting thing is, my understanding, and I found it to be true, is when a car stops or slows down in front of me, I don't even have to apply the brake. Of course, I had my foot over the brake just in case, but there was a little bit of a slowdown ahead, and I noticed my car was slowing down. And then eventually, cars ahead of me stopped completely. And as my car was approaching the stopped vehicles, it started to slow down gradually, slower and slower, until it reached a certain distance from the car in front of me and came to a dead stop. My car came to a dead stop without having me applying the brake at all. My foot was over the brake pedal, but I did not touch it. And what do you think of that?
Sounds nice and safe. So an awful lot of rear-end accidents will be automatically canceled by the artificial intelligence of your car, Andy. Owner's manual describes all of this operation.
Yes. Yeah, I have yet to read the second chapter of the manual because it is so thick. It's like looking at an encyclopedia. There's a lot of stuff to read and absorb. So that's the way the eyesight works. And that's one of the reasons why I got this car. It even saved me on my insurance because if you look in Consumer Reports, as far as the ratings of the car, it came in as the highest rated car as far as safety is concerned, and that's reflected on my insurance that I'm paying for insurance because of these features. The other thing I just wanted to mention is regarding the backup camera. I found out, and this became a law now, and it's also a good thing. Although I didn't verify, but I was told this, and I want to check it out. Any car that has a backup camera that's manufactured after 2018, so 2018 going forward, that has a backup camera, when you get your car inspected each year, they have to check the backup camera to see if it works. And if it doesn't work, it won't pass inspection. It would be part of the inspection routine. So that's good to know also, because they want to make sure that the backup camera is working. And that's from 2018 forward. if you have a 2017 and you have a backup camera that doesn't, from what I've heard, it doesn't, they will, they'll still pass, it'll still pass inspection, because a lot of cars don't have backup cameras. But now, you know, it's becoming more mandatory that these safety devices are incorporated. So it's something to keep in mind, you know, in case you're getting your car inspected in the future and you have a backup camera, make sure it's working, along with other safety features which I have to yet to find out. So I thought I'd mention that, Dick. Back to you, W8CDO.
Those are nice features. Break off for a second and tell us, what's the best buy you saw at the Call of Science? Were there any real good ones that got away from you, Andy? And was somebody selling an R390 for $100? How about you, K2RIW?
Well, as you know, I do the tune-up testing, so I don't walk around. And I have more stuff than I'm ever going to need, so I'm not spending any money. I do want to get a new radio. That's one thing that's in mind. Getting back to this car business, I want to get a new radio because my the newer cars have all these Bluetooth and all this wireless technology around it also. And my understanding is that some of the companies, Yaesu, Icom, Kenwood doesn't have it yet, are coming out with these radios that have the Bluetooth technology built in. So as for safety, and so this is the reason why I'm mentioning it, with that, you can operate your radio now completely wireless. And they actually make a headset that you could use. And it's got a microphone and, of course, your speakers. And you could use that. And that's also Bluetooth adaptable. So the point is that you can operate your ham radio hands-free and concentrate on driving with this technology. So I want to get a new radio that has the Bluetooth and play around with it and see how it's going to interface to my car. So that will be something to play with. So that's on the list, but I didn't look today. I'll find it at NearFest. There'll be a couple of vendors up there that I'm sure will be selling, maybe at a good price. So we'll see. So the point is I didn't look around because I'm situated in one spot, and I'm busy enough anyway. So it distracts me, and I don't have to spend any money, and I don't have to bring any money. So it's a good thing, Dick. It's for me anyway. All right, back to you, WHCDO.
If you were operating your radio with a Bluetooth wireless headset, would you be using voice-operated relay? How do you turn the transmitter on when you want to make a transmission? Voice-operated relays are kind of not pleasant to listen to. You'd really like to press a button and have it go to the transmit mode, release the button, you know, push to talk. How do you do the push to talk function with a wireless Bluetooth headset, Andy? Go ahead.
My understanding, and this is the reason why I want to play, because I have to see how this is going to work, that it is Vox operated. It is Vox operated, although I don't know how well the Vox works. I don't know if the Vox is subject to erroneous sounds in the car. If it could be adjusted, if it could be noise, you could set it up for noise canceling and so on, I don't know. But according to what I read and what I was told, it is Vox operated, and that's how you push the talk. So you don't have to press the button, which is good. You just start talking. Now, if somebody else talks in the car, I don't know. So if you have a passenger in the car, the question is, will it go into transmit? I want to see how this works. I want to get a demonstration of it. But a few of the radios have this Bluetooth little module that you can add, and I want to see. I want to get an idea how it works out. All right, back to you.
AC2GS. Go right ahead, Roy.
Good evening. This is Lester and Yonkers. Yes, I'm listening in. Yeah, there's also a Bluetooth button that gets attached to your steering wheel. You hit that Bluetooth button, and it allows you to speak. Pretty much all I have to say on regards to that.
Thank you, but I passed it over to Roy. AC2GS, K2RIW. Go ahead, Dr. Roy.
Thank you, Dick, and I guess I doubled with that other gentleman. Well, pretty much the same thing. There are headsets that have buttons on the side. You can use that as a push-to-talk. I have a Anytone D878UV, which is a DMR dual band that comes with Bluetooth enabled, and it has a separate little push-to-talk button that you can strap on to a steering wheel or on your finger, wherever you want to do it, and control the push-to-talk function that way.
Yeah, I would prefer a push-to-talk. Vox has got a couple of disadvantages. You ever listen to somebody with a Vox transmitter? Yeah, it's continuously going on and off as he talks, and we all have pauses in our speech. Second of all, if you're driving with a headset and somebody cuts you off and you shout some profanity, that goes out over the air. Because the microphone is directly in front of your mouth, you can easily set the Vox sensitivity so that only your voice would turn it on and somebody else in the car wouldn't. But still, the bursts of speech and delay time in between makes Vox quite unpleasant to listen to, in my opinion. So you'd really want push to talk, particularly on repeater service. With single sideband, Vox is not so bad, but with FM on a repeater, I don't think you really want to operate that with Vox. So the push-to-talk button on the steering wheel or on the headset sounds like the way to go, Andy. And give us a couple of words on Shelby. Are they getting a good showing these days? And I guess that's a nice long trip you took with your brand-new car. The V2 CDL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, W-H-C-D-L. Yeah, hello to Roy again. How you doing? Yeah, so in regard to Vox, I was led to believe it has the Vox capability. Along with push-to-talk, I guess push-to-talk would be, you know, a standard, and using Vox would be, if you wanted to do it that way. But I have to find this out. I gotta do some more research on it. But I know. See, the thing is, you know, these new cars. My new car has a microphone built in also, because I can make phone calls. I could pair my car through Bluetooth to my Android or iPhone, which has Bluetooth built in, and I've done that. And then you could. You know, it's right on the steering wheel. You just press a button, and it brings up the menu, and then you can scroll down. The screen is also a touch screen on the dashboard, and you scroll down to the phone number you want to dial, and then you touch it, and then you dial out, and of course that's hands free. So when you're making a phone call, you know, you could. Although I don't know. Good question. I got to think about. Some features are not activated while you're driving. You may have to pull over. You may have to put it in neutral or park to operate it. But the point is, it does have a microphone built into the car, so you can make phone calls from your car, and that's hands-free also. I have a lot more to learn. I haven't played with all the things that this thing does, only because I got to do more driving, long distance driving to do it. I haven't made that many. I think I made one phone call so far from the car, rather from the car, not going through my iPhone or Android. Okay, Shelby, yeah, it was lighter than normal, or lighter than last year. Last year was more crowded. As I mentioned earlier, Shelby's normally a 3-day event. People were packing up and leaving after one day. So by the second day, it was there was a lot of empty spaces. And by the third day, it was very, very light. There was just a handful of people. So it seemed like there were more sellers than buyers for whatever reason. It was, you know, a lot of people showed up.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Okay, let me make sure I have the beep. I got a couple of beeps. All in all, Dick, I haven't been to Dayton in many, many years. The last time I was in Dayton was back in the 80s. And I know they have a new venue location, but even that attendance has been down over the years. Things are changing. And, I don't think, the popularity of amateur radio, I don't know. I haven't read any statistics lately to know how many people are getting into the hobby as compared to how many people are moving on to the next life or getting out of the hobby or what have you. So, but you still see the boat anchors and people are trying to get rid of those, and a lot of people don't even know what they are. As I said, when Rich came on and started talking about the boat anchors, it raised an eyebrow. Like, what boat anchor would he have? You know, because back then, as you know, back in the 50s and 60s, that's all people used, all these tube-type radios. And ask the average ham now, what's a tube? And they would probably say, well, maybe it's something that glows. But, you know, that's the way it is. All right, back to you, Dick. I'm just rambling on. I'm going to CDO.
Comment, N1YDY.
Go ahead, Hank.
Yeah, Andy, I was listening to you talking about the eyesight in your car, and just, I have one of these, as you know, and the interesting thing about allowing you to make a phone call is that they only allow you to access the numbers that are in your VIP list rather than the entire phone list while the car is moving. So there's only, I think, 6 or 7 numbers that you can dial while the car is driving. Otherwise, the car has to be stopped. And it's not a position of the gear shift lever. That's not a function of neutral or park. It's a function of whether or not there's any GPS movement in the car.
Oh, okay. I hello to you. It's been a long time. I only used it once to make a phone call, and I believe I was moving when I made the call, I think. It's when I first got the car. But because it asked me to download the, the phone numbers in my iPhone. There's a list that you can you download onto the screen, which is what I did. But I haven't used it since. So, okay. Which car do you have that has eyesight? Is it the also a Subaru? But I'll let me pass it to Dick because he's controlling. Go ahead, Dick.
I'm not. That's how I'm obeying protocol. Go ahead, Hank.
In the family, we have 2 Subi Outbacks. One's a 16 and the other is a 13. And the 13 does not have eyesight, but the 16 does. And I concur with most of what you said about how it works and it maintains the spacing relative to the vehicle in front of you once you're within 4 or 5 car lengths when it figures things out. But the interesting thing is that the GPS and the telephone will allow you in both cars, even though they're different generations of Outbacks, will not allow you to make phone calls from your telephone, what do they call it, phone book list, I believe. But they will allow you to make the calls from the people that are in your VIP or most recently dialed list. So it's sort of an interesting feature. It doesn't really make a lot of sense to me not allow you to access the phone numbers or it dials or even downloads until such time as the vehicle is stopped. And both cars do it exactly the same way.
Yeah, I rented a 2019 Toyota Camry when I was in Florida back in April. And what I've noticed is that the GPS is extremely fast in response. In other words, it knows exactly what direction you're going and how fast you're going within fractions of a second. A normal GPS receiver doesn't have anywhere near that speed or accuracy. Therefore, I'm convinced that the GPS function in modern day